Good morning, welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. I'm Robin Proud. I have the honor to be one of the rotating speakers here. I have a quote from Madame Restel, today's subject. Much of the suffering, misery, wretchedness, and vice existing around us can be attributable to our ignorance of the capacity granted to us to control, in no small degree, our own destinies. I have a short reading from this book, The Trials of Madame Restel. The charged debates about abortion, laden with notions of life and death, gender, sexuality, and childhood, both were and were not about abortion itself. In the 19th century, abortion, as well as people like Madame Restel who provided it, became symbols for societal changes, the size of families, the authority of doctors, the origin of the nation's populace, women's autonomy. While the issues that animate today's debate about abortion are different in some ways from those of the 19th century, at their heart, they can still be condensed down to whether we believe that a woman should be entrusted with making among the most important choices she can about her own body and livelihood. So this is one of the women that I've talked about that you probably said, who? Because I did as well. I believe in the New York Times Book Review, in 2023, there was an essay about these two books that came out around the same time. And that's not a coincidence. It was after the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So this one, Nicholas Siret, The Trials of Madame Restel, 19th Century America's Most Infamous Female Physician and the Campaign to Make Abortion a Crime. And this is written for a general audience. Madame Restel, the life, death, and resurrection of old New York's most fabulous, fearless, and infamous abortionist by Jennifer Wright is even more colloquial and often quite snarky in giving a lot of references to today. Both of these are available through the library and, of course, online or in other booksellers. So this woman who is unknown to us featured in all the scandal sheets of the day. Of course, her name was not Madame Restel. And there was nothing French about her. She was born Anne Trow, T-R-O-W, in an English village in 1811. Like many other girls, she went into service at age 15 for a butcher's family. This was no grand mansion, so she would have been a maid of all work. Later in life, she paid her servants more and treated them better than many employers. And she was early aware of the threats to young women in service from the gentlemen of the house. At age 16, she married an apprentice tailor, Henry Summers. He turned out to be an alcoholic and ended up doing much of his work, thereby learning to be an excellent seamstress. When she heard that good wages were available in America, she convinced her husband Henry to set sail with their toddler daughter for New York. This was 1831. Like many others, they found the streets weren't paved with gold or with anything around the infamous Five Points neighborhood where they could afford to live. They also found there was a huge amount of competition in the sewing trade from other impoverished women, including prostitutes who sometimes made a little extra money sewing and mending. Fortunately, Anne made the acquaintance of a neighbor, William Evans, a quack doctor who sold pills and other medicines, but he may have had some knowledge. He trained her as his assistant. It was here that women began to come to her for help with unwanted pregnancies. Anne was probably familiar with folk remedies that have been used for centuries. You might have heard that Benjamin Franklin even provided a recipe for an abortifacient in one of his writings. During this time, Anne met Charles Lohmann, the man who would become her second husband. He was an atheist and a follower of Robert Dale Owen, a very famous free thinker. So when Anne's husband Henry died, probably of drink, only 2 years after their arrival, she married Charles. And as far as Anne, later Madame Restel's religious views, I think that they were largely shaped by this introduction from her husband, and also the hypocrisy that she saw in the church. The same people who would condemn her during the day would sneak around at night with their mistresses for her help. So her husband was a new husband was a printer, and he saw that there were so many advertisements for patent medicine and relief from, quote, female problems in the newspaper. So he and his new wife dreamed up the name and background of a woman from France whose concoctions must have come from her grandmother. This happens. Haagen-Dazs is not made in any foreign country, right? It just sounds cooler that way, that sort of thing. Now, there was a considerable difference in attitude in both Britain and America between the early and the late 19th century in the matter of sex and reproduction. In the late 18th, early 19th, which was the Georgian and Regency periods, they were known for their licentiousness. That was largely why Victoria and Albert made it a priority to be proper, even puritanical. But in the 1830s, Restel was only one of the women advertising similar services, which included contraception and both chemical and surgical abortions. We don't know who taught her to perform these operations. It may have been this Dr. Evans who taught her pill making. An amazing statistic is that throughout her career, even though she was under great scrutiny, there is no record of anyone under her care dying. This was much better than the doctor's records. And some women came back multiple times since there weren't many alternatives for women. Soon Restel was famous enough to figure in the newspaper wars. Some wrote of her as a beautiful female physician, while others condemned her as evil. When one of her patients quailed at taking the pills Restel offered her and consulted a physician, that doctor told the woman to go to the police. So in August 1839, Madame Restel was arrested for providing an abortion. At this time, abortions performed in the pre-quickening period, which was generally before 20 weeks, were a misdemeanor. Those later were a felony. Restel was bailed out and had enough money for a good lawyer. The newspapers expected a series of sexy articles, but Restel didn't show up. The case was finally dropped. Meanwhile, the woman who had reported her decided not to take the pills, gave birth, and died soon after of what was called childbed fever, which was almost certainly introduced by doctors who didn't wash their hands. So she would have been better off with Restel. Of course, this did not end accusations against Madame Restel. In a quote that resonates today, some men felt that contraception and abortion gave women a license to be promiscuous and get away with it. Of course, you know, men's behavior is irrelevant, right? Now, Restel replied in the press that she was actually encouraging marriage because women wouldn't feel it was always a prelude to early pregnancy and possible death. Abigail Adams, the reason she didn't go to Europe with her husband was that she was afraid she would get pregnant on this long sea voyage or have a baby or have a baby in a strange country, and these were legitimate fears. And also Restel reminded the public that she saved lives of women who could have more children and take care of the ones they had. She could not accept the view that the only force restraining women was fear of pregnancy. And we heard the same thing, those of us that were around when the pill was introduced. Here's one of the snarky quotes from Jennifer Wright's biography. No one in any period of history has ever had as much sex as men thought briefly unchaperoned 19th century women had. So, right? They thought, oh, you let them out of your sight for a minute. But again, they can't do this alone. So this time, that trial did not go on. But in 1839, a woman named Anna Marie Purdy was dying at the age of 21. She claimed her health had deteriorated after an abortion performed by Restel 2 years before. Actually, it seems clear she was dying of tuberculosis. But Restel didn't deny performing the procedure. She was arrested, and bail was put at the high amount of $5,000. Although Restel was amassing a good nest egg and had rich friends, nobody wanted to be seen as publicly supporting her. She ended up spending 2 months in a New York jail called the Tombs. However, she was allowed her own room and visitors who could bring her food, clothing, and books. She was finally bailed out, and by the time of the trial, Anna Marie Purdy had died, the young woman who brought the suit. This made it easy for Restel's lawyer to blacken the accuser's character. Still, Ristill was convicted, but she immediately repealed, and she got off on a technicality because the original complainant was no longer available to testify. Public opinion was divided on Ristill. Some admired her looks, her elegant wardrobe, and her private carriage, and there were often descriptions of these things in newspapers. Others condemned her as a murderess. In 1844, another lawsuit blamed Ristill for a woman's death. Everyone agreed that Ristill had successfully treated this woman to end her pregnancy. But it seems that a few months later, the woman again was pregnant, but went to one of Ristill's competitors. And this practitioner did not provide any nursing or follow-up, as Ristill always did. She would keep women with her for some days. And there were a number of these competitors, and some even used Ristill's name fraudulently in their advertising. Ristill was acquitted, but the case led to a change in New York state law. Now anyone providing a chemical or surgical abortion was committing a felony and could spend 2 to 5 years in jail rather than the 1 year for the previous status of misdemeanor. And women who had abortions could be sentenced to 3 to 12 months in jail. Ristill was now the breadwinner in the family with her husband as a lesser figure, but he did take over the pill-making and selling business, and he published a book entitled The Married Woman's Private Medical Companion, which was not unrelated to their work. Ristill's legal troubles weren't over. In 1847, a woman named Maria Bodine claimed she was suffering as a result of an abortion performed by Ristill. Ristill testified, given how far into the pregnancy Maria was, she had advised her not to have the abortion, but to put her baby up for adoption. And this is also something that Ristill sometimes assisted with, letting the women stay with her and having the baby sent to an orphanage or some other place, which may not have been very good at the time, but was an option. Maria still insisted on an abortion, and the procedure went well. But as in the previous case, there was more going on. Maria had syphilis, which predated the pregnancy. However, this time Ristill was convicted of a misdemeanor and sent for a year to Blackwell's Island. This place, since renamed Roosevelt Island, was the home of the institution infiltrated by journalist Nellie Bly, so there was an insane asylum and a prison there. The conditions were truly terrible, but somehow Ristill again arranged special treatment. She had a larger private cell with a feather bed. She was allowed to wear her own clothes and provided with a closet for them. Her husband paid for meals to be sent to her. She even paid other prisoners to clean her cell. To be fair, other wealthy prisoners, usually men, had arranged similar perks. Ristill had delayed her sentence as long as possible with appeals, so she entered the jail in June 1849, and in November the governor pardoned her and she was released. Ristill went back to her work, which often included taking care of women impregnated by the very men who condemned her in public. A wealthy businessman, George Shackford, seduced a 15-year-old girl named Cordelia. In the next few years, he paid for her to have 5 abortions, 3 done by Ristill. When Cordelia realized he was tiring of her, maybe because she was at the advanced age of 20 now, she demanded $6,000. He refused to pay, so Cordelia reported both Shackford and Ristill to the police. They were both arrested. Ristill denied the charges, and Cordelia didn't show up at the trial. Although there were rumors about a mysterious death, probably Shackford finally paid her off to get her to leave town. With no witnesses, the charges were dropped. In the 1850s, Ristill, like other nouveau riche New Yorkers, focused on establishing herself in society. She gave her daughter an excellent education and a fashionable wardrobe. And her daughter married a man who was the son of a builder. But Ristill's quest for acceptance was thwarted by new lawsuits. In 1855, a servant came to Ristill asking that the child she would soon have be put up for adoption. Ristill kept her in the house, and after the birth, she hired her as a servant. Something happened that caused Ristill to fire her. We don't know what. 8 months after the birth, the servant, Frederica Mettinger, went to the police claiming Ristill had stolen her child. Frederica was an inconsistent witness who kept changing her story, but she continued to sue for years. In 1856, another young woman, Elizabeth Kaiser, was brought to Ristill by her employer, who had impregnated her and claimed he would marry her. After the abortion, he told her he was marrying someone else. So Elizabeth accused him and Restel of performing an illegal procedure. Nothing came of this accusation either, except to give Restel a lot of free advertising. There was plenty of business because male doctors had avoided women's health care and were rarely trained in it. Midwives and abortionists had the experience and empathy doctors lacked. But as doctors organized themselves, founding the American Medical Association in 1847, they wanted a bigger share of this market. Some of them joined with anti-abortion forces. They also championed drastic cures for women's issues, such as a complete hysterectomy. And of course, if you look at some of the recent executive orders and comments, you'll see that the understanding of women's anatomy and physiology by men has not improved a lot for some people. By this time, Restel had a small fortune because she had invested in stocks and real estate. She traveled in luxury to Europe and provided generously for her daughter and grandchildren. Her son-in-law turned out to be another alcoholic. He was captured in the Civil War and died in the infamous Andersonville prison. So she took charge of her daughter and grandchildren. Now, like other newcomers to the upper class, she wanted to build a mansion in the newly fashionable uptown area of New York City. So this is when the Vanderbilts and the Astors and all of them were building their new homes. And Archbishop John Hughes was building the magnificent new St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. His plan was to build a house for himself next door. But he made the mistake of attacking Madame Restel from the pulpit. So in modern times, we would say she trolled him. She purchased for herself the land he intended for his home. Parishioners at his church would be forced to admire the grand mansion she built next door. And it was written up, three stories, and everything elegant, even the stables, were made of mahogany with accents of silver. And in the basement, there was a basic medical office where she still dispensed contraceptives and performed surgery as needed. The rest of the house was equal to anything constructed for the Astors or the Vanderbilts. Her daughter and the children moved into the mansion. Then her daughter decided to remarry a policeman. To Restel, that was the enemy, so she suggested that just the grandchildren stay with her. Granddaughter Carrie became Restel's apprentice. A wave of religious fervor in the later part of the 19th century contributed to a reevaluation of abortion. In 1869, the New York State Legislature passed a bill making abortion a misdemeanor, regardless of how far the pregnancy had advanced. So this eliminated the traditional notion of quickening. Some incompetent and male abortionists were prosecuted for cases that ended in deaths of women. And reformers, besides their concern with alcohol and prostitution, set their sights on abortion. The most famous of these was Anthony Comstock. Comstock was obsessed with sin of all kinds. He condemned what he called self-abuse by men, pornographic pictures, and of course, abortion. Some of his work included buying up said pictures with the intent of destroying them. I don't know if he peaked first. He was so extreme that he was often ridiculed in the press and cartoons. One cartoon depicted Comstock dragging a woman before a judge declaring, "Your Honor, this woman gave birth to a naked child." However, he got the last laugh when the federal government passed what became known and still known as the Comstock Act. Among other things, it forbade sending information on contraception or abortion through the mail, as well as pills that might be used for these purposes. And a week ago, a court in Louisiana, I think, right, accused a New York doctor who happened to be a woman of sending pills by the mail to someone there, and that was against their state laws. New York State has a protective law, but probably the point of all of this is to get this to go through the courts, and perhaps the Supreme Court will say, oh, every state can make their own decision on this. Not sure about the whole interstate commerce thing, but Comstock's influence is still here. So with this new world in her time, Restel reduced her advertising and toned down some of the language, but she was still doing a brisk business. Her land purchase had enough room for another building, so she built what was probably only the second apartment building in the city. This was very luxurious, with elevators, a restaurant, and a doorman. One night in the winter of 1878, a man came to Madame Restelle's door, asking to speak to her about a private matter. This happened regularly, and as always, it concerned a woman, not his wife, who was pregnant. She sold him pills and told him that if they didn't have the right effect, she could do surgery. But this was a front. The man was Anthony Comstock, and he came back 2 weeks later with the police. When the police found contraceptives and pills, Restelle insisted they were no different from those found in any pharmacy, which could be the case at the time. They ordered her to come in before a judge. She agreed, but insisted on taking her own carriage. She requested to be released because she had women in her care back at her home. When the judge set bail at $10,000, she pulled out the money. She had brought $20,000 with her. But he insisted on a real estate bond, which would take time to solicit. So Restelle was once again remanded to the Tombs. Once more, she had special accommodations. After 3 days, her lawyer and her grandson were able to find someone to post bail in the form of property. When Restelle came back for the trial, the journalist reported in great detail her finery, including a sealskin cape and velvet hat. At the hearings, Restelle changed her attitude, insisting she hadn't performed any abortions for the last 12 years and begging almost hysterically to be released from jail. Was this just a ploy? On Thursday, March 29th, 1878, she entered a plea of not guilty, and the trial was scheduled to start the following Monday. But that day, Monday, April 1st, she didn't arrive in court. Suddenly, her lawyer burst in with the news that Madame Restelle was dead. Her maid reported that in the morning, she saw the bathroom door open, which wasn't usual at that time of day. Looking inside, she saw a body in the tub with its neck slashed, the nightgown and robe neatly folded on a chair. Of course, this was a media sensation. Was it murder, suicide, or a hoax? It was April 1st. The coroner declared it a suicide. Household members attested to Restelle's disturbed state in recent days. Comstock claimed she must have been overcome by her conscience after her murderous career, but that's extremely unlikely. She left a fortune to her daughter and grandchildren. Surprisingly, in this Victorian era, many Americans took the side of the abortionist, blaming Comstock for hounding her to her death. He was untroubled and moved on to attacking other purveyors of birth control and abortion. Understandably, there were rumors that the corpse was someone else, that Madame Restelle had escaped to Europe or Canada. In this theory, the family members and even the coroner would have been in on the deception. The corpse wore her rings, but they could have been put on a substitute body. The grandchildren made regular trips to Europe. Were they visiting her? So, you know, perhaps she's somewhere with, what, Elvis and JFK. But with such a scandalous figure, it's totally understandable. Of course, the demise of Madame Restelle did nothing to stop the demand for abortion, just as no modern laws can do that. And yes, even today, we need more people like Madame Restelle to supply necessary and safe service to women and families. So, yes, the very dramatic life of this woman. So do we have some comments or questions? My understanding is she did begin making money from her work, and then she invested wisely. But she did offer lower prices to women, because there was one story in there about that where she was willing to negotiate if they did not have her usual fee. But yes, it sounds like she was able to make quite a bit from her work, but then also made some good investments. I think a lot of this was traditional, midwives and women who knew these things over the years. And there were certain, was it tansy? There were certain herbs that were known to be effective or often effective in causing abortions or preventing pregnancy. And I don't know when one of my other talks was about the Blackwell sisters, who were the first female doctors in America who had to go to Scotland for training. I think, originally the doctors sort of felt this was beneath them to deal with these women's problems, and then they wanted to get in on the business and decided what they thought would be best. And we still have that. That's another controversy about what and how much midwives should be allowed to do in certain states and how they're licensed and how they're looked on by doctors. Yeah, I always do wonder about all these immaculate conceptions when men are never mentioned anywhere in these debates. And then some of these stories we heard of people who had very wanted pregnancies and something horrible was going wrong later in the pregnancy, and that the men involved were like, oh, I never thought this would affect me. It never dawned on me that this could be an issue, and I almost lost my wife for this. So, or they did lose a family member. Thank you, everyone. And for this closing words, I did not put the whole phrase in, and you'll know why in a minute, from this book by Jennifer Wright. Restelle was a businesswoman, a scofflaw, an immigrant, and an abortionist. She made men really, really mad, italicized. She deserves a place in the pantheon of women with no fucks left to give. I did not put that in there. And then I'll read the rest of the paragraph here. But despite her impact, she has been largely lost to history. Most Americans don't know her name at all, and those who do have a less than accurate impression of who she was. That applies to almost everyone I've ever talked about here. Every existing record of her life reduces her, Madame Restelle, somehow to only an activist, only a villain, only a campy showwoman, only the tragic victim hounded to death by Anthony Comstock. Madame Restelle was so much more than any one thing. She was unrestrainable, unapologetic, a survivor, the kind of woman who has always existed in America and always will.